Good morning. Turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 15. 2 Samuel 15, in case you are visiting or this is your first week in a while, we're actually wrapping up a series today, six-week series, on the life of King David. And I've been calling this series Faithfulness Through Adversity. You look at David's life, and you see some great things, but you see a lot of adversity. It's a lot of challenges, a lot of hard things. And yet, through it, you see a faithfulness. Through thick and thin, you see David's faithfulness. And more importantly, you see God's faithfulness to David through thick and thin. And most of the time, we've been looking at these external adversities that David faced, like a big giant named Goliath, or Saul, the former king, or armies, you know, these external adversities. Last week, we looked at an internal adversity, his own sin. And we looked at the story of David and Bathsheba, this tragic fall of a leader, and a series of mistakes that he made. And in this final week, we're going to look at some more adversity in David's life, and we're basically going to look at the aftermath of the fallout with David and Bathsheba and Uriah. We're going to see how David has to suffer and live out the consequences of his sin in that situation. And yet, we're going to see a faithfulness even in there. We'll see God's faithfulness to him and his faithfulness to continue to commit himself to the Lord, even in the midst of his sin. And I want to end the series a little differently today. I don't want to so much focus on David, which is what we've been doing. We've been focusing on him and his decisions. Today, I want to focus on people's reactions to David, people's responses to God's anointed king. And we're going to look at a situation where David's kingdom seems to be teetering. He's lost power. It looks like there's a new king coming in and a new kingdom coming in the way. And in the midst of that clash of kingdoms, you find people that are having to make a decision. Who am I going to follow? Am I going to follow David or this new guy that's up and coming? And so we'll look at the various responses that people have to God's anointed king, David. And ultimately, what I want to do is end this series by pointing forward to Jesus Christ, God's ultimate, anointed, perfect, eternal king. And the question will be, what is our response to God's king now? What is our response to Jesus? And so the question that I want to pose right at the beginning is, where is our allegiance? Where is our allegiance? All right, so I'm going to step back and give you a little context for the chapter that we're going to look at. Last week, we looked at chapters 11 and 12, so I just want to catch you up. And I've got a little PowerPoint here. Reminder of what happened last week after the fallout with Bathsheba and Uriah. God says this to David. And these two consequences for his sin. You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and took his wife to be your own. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despise me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Oh, that's funny. You did it in secret, but I will do it in broad daylight. Interesting. Good editing on my part there. So basically, God says, I'm going to remain faithful to you. I've forgiven you, but you're going to have to live with the consequences of these sins. You used the sword so the sword won't depart from your house, and you commit adultery with this woman, so sexual immorality is going to follow your house. And now we're going to see that played out. So let me give you the aftermath of David's sin. So here's what happens in chapter 13. David's son, Amnon, gets obsessed with his half-sister. David has several wives. And he falls in love with his half-sister, Tamar, and ends up raping her. Okay? That's a fun story. Absalom, one of David's other sons, ends up killing He's Tamar's full brother, and he ends up killing Amnon. Then Absalom, in light of having murdered one of the king's sons, he flees Jerusalem and stays outside for a while. And then over time, he returns to Jerusalem and is reconciled with the king, with David. And then over time, Absalom starts leading this conspiracy against his father, against David. And so I want us to look at some verses that capture how this conspiracy starts. Okay, so look at chapter 15, verse 1. This is one of David's own sons. And again, what we're looking at is the consequences of David's sin. Verse 1. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. Now look at this strategy. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. This is the capital city of Jerusalem. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before King David for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" He would answer, "Your servant is from the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land. Then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me, and I would see that he gets justice right." Verse 5, "Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him." So Absalom, right under David's nose, is wooing the people of Israel away from David the king and saying, "Man, if I were king, I would be a man of the people. I would listen to your concerns, and there would be justice." And where's King David right now? He's not here waiting for you at the city gate. So look at this verse 6. Look at this profound statement. "Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. And so," here it is, "he stole the hearts of the men of Israel." He deceived them, and he stole the hearts of all of Israel from King David. So, verse 13, look at verse 13. So a messenger, finally news of this gets to David. A messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And all of a sudden, David the king, we don't know what he's been doing, but all of a sudden he realizes that right under his nose, his own son has been betraying him and drawing the people's hearts towards him. And all of a sudden, it's like this groundswell has reached a tipping point. And all of a sudden, David realizes that, wow, Absalom has the hearts of the people. Absalom has more power than I do. And it's like this, it happens overnight almost. And all of a sudden David realizes, oh my gosh, if he has the power, if he has the military, if he has the hearts of the military, I'm in trouble. He's gonna come in and he's gonna knock me out, and we're in trouble. And so David in an instant says, we have to flee Jerusalem. We've got to get out of the city before this takes place. Absalom is not in the city at the time. So last thing is, so David flees Jerusalem. Let me give you some verses that cover this. Again, this is all just context to what I want to say today. Verse 14, "Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, 'Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword.' The king's officials answered him, 'Your servants are ready to do whatever your lord the king chooses.' The king set out with his entire household following him, but he left 10 concubines to take care of the palace." That will prove a really bad decision. So the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. All his men marched past him along with all the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath marched before the king. Let me skip to verse 23. Look at these images of King David leaving the capital city. "The whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert." So clearly some people are still loyal to David, and they're crying as they're watching their king have to flee his own capital city, fleeing from his own son. Then look at verse 30. "David continued up the Mount of Olives," this is right by Jerusalem, "and he's weeping as he went. His head was covered, and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too, and were weeping as they went up." So you've got this picture of this, you know, king who's lost power, and now he's showing signs of mourning. He's barefoot, he's covered, he's weeping, and everybody's weeping. Now he's having to flee from his own son. And just to finish off this story, go to chapter 16, verse 21. This is what happened. Absalom finally enters the city. David's able to get out in time. And this is what Absalom does. He asks his counselor, who we'll hear more about. He says, "What should I do now that I'm here?" And verse 21, his counselor Ahithophel answers, "Lie with your father's concubines, whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench in your father's nostrils, and the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof of the palace, and he lay with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Wow. Okay. Doing two things, really. First, obviously, defying his father, and then making a claim to the kingship by laying with the king's concubines. So you've got the aftermath of David's sin, and two things are very clear to me throughout these chapters. One is this, David is clearly suffering from the consequences of his sin. God said, hey, you were violent and you committed sexual immorality, so those two things are going to follow your household, and that's exactly what's happening. But the other thing that's clear is this, and this is important for us. David is still God's anointed king. God has not abandoned David. He is still God's man. God is still working his kingdom through this man, David. He's going to be faithful to him. All right, so that's just by way of context. Now let me get to what I actually want to say today. So what I want to focus on this morning is the people's response to this situation. Okay, and I want you to try to put yourselves right now in the shoes of the average Israelite. Maybe you're a soldier, maybe you're just a citizen. The average Israelite, put yourself in their shoes. And you've got these two kings now, these two competing kingdoms. And the question is, where's your allegiance going to be? What are you going to choose to do in the midst of this changing of the guard? At least what appears to be that. And you look at David, and by all appearances, he looks weak. It looks like his time has come. He's lost touch with his kingship, and he is vulnerable. He's lost the military, and he's on his way out. And yet he is God's anointed king. So are you going to follow him? Are you going to remain loyal to him or not? And on the other hand, you got Absalom. He's this young guy. He's vibrant. He's winsome. And he's got the political edge. So what do you do? Who do you choose? And really, how do you make that decision? Do you make it from a pragmatic standpoint and just go, let's see, who do I think is going to win this thing? I want to be with that guy. Or are you driven by some core values of what you really believe in and who you think is gonna you know, be in line with that? How do you make that decision? Well, what I want to do is look at some snapshots today, six quick snapshots of various people caught in the midst of this making decisions. And we've got some great names today. I just want to give them to you right now. Hushai the Archite, Ittai the Gittite, Barzillai, Ahithophel, Ziba, Shimei, household names in the 21st century. I don't need to tell you about them, but just by way of review, we'll find out about these guys. And what I want to do is, first we're going to look at three negative responses to God's anointed, and then three positive responses. And we're going to have to kind of jump around a little bit, so this is going to feel a little jumpy, but try to just see the various responses to what is going on between these two kings. All right, so we're going to start with three negative responses. The first guy is this guy, Ahithophel, and which I think that's how you say it, but I kind of wasn't sure. Let me tell you who this guy was. He was David's trusted counselor. He was the advisor to the king. Chapter 16, verse 23, don't go there, says, "Now in those days the advice of Ahithophel, the advice that he gave was like that of one who inquires of God." That's how both David and Absalom regarded his advice. So they're like, whatever this guy says is gold. And he's been David's trusted advisor for years. But look what happens. Go to now chapter 15. We're going to be in chapter 15 and 16 for most of our time here. Chapter 15 and verse 12. This is just before David flees from Jerusalem. Absalom is gaining momentum. He's gaining followers. And look at verse 12. While Absalom he's outside of Jerusalem, and this is where Ahithophel is. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come from Gilo, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. So we don't get a lot of details about this guy, but apparently Absalom comes to him and says, "You've been advisor to my father. Now look what's going on. I want you to be advisor to me." And Ahithophel looks at the situation, he looks at where the momentum is, and he sees this young guy with power and momentum and followers, and he says, "This is the future. This is it. David is on his way out, and this guy is on his way in." And I'm looking at these two things. Here's where I want to be. If I've got a future in the realm of advising, this is where it is. And so he makes this pragmatic decision, says, "I want to be in power. I want to be with the guy who's going to win." And he chooses to betray his trusted friend David, the king, and go over to this new king. So there's one snapshot. Let's look at the second one. This guy named Ziba. This is at the beginning of chapter 16. This is as David is leaving the city. This guy comes out, and he's also thinking practically. just like Ahithophel was. He sees the opportunity, he sees David leaving as this opportunity to take advantage of something and get something that he wants. So, verse 1, when David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth, another great name, waiting to meet him. Anybody know who Mephibosheth was? Nice, well done. Yes, are you guys looking at your notes, or is this like by memory? So Mephibosheth was Saul's grandson, son of Jonathan. He was, you know, part of Saul's family. And, you know, when David became king, there's this great danger, if you're in Saul's family, that he's going to wipe you out, because he wants to wipe up any potential, you know, would-be kings from that family. And yet Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son. And when he was like 5, there's this story where his nurse was carrying him and running, and she dropped him, and he fell, and he like broke both of his feet, and so he was lame in both of his feet. So he couldn't walk for the rest of his life, and he had, you know, whatever the equivalent of a wheelchair or however you got around in those days, he had that. And David made this great promise to him and said, hey, I'm going to take care of you. Even though you're from Saul's family, you can come and be with me in my palace. And so he brought him into Jerusalem, and Mephibosheth always ate with David and his people, and it was this really neat picture of mercy and commitment, really, to Jonathan. And so that's who Mephibosheth is. And Ziba is his steward, his caretaker. And look at verse 1. So he comes out to David, and he had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisin, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. The king asked Ziba, why have you brought these? Ziba answered, the donkeys are for you, for the king's household to ride on. The bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert. So it looks like this really generous gesture, right? As the king's going out, let me give you all these things. Let me help you and provide for you. And let me tell you that this is totally motivated by selfish motivations. All right, he goes on, verse 3, David asks him, where's your master's grandson? Where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba's going to say something, and let me just tell you, he's lying through his teeth, okay? We learn this later. We're not going to read it, but it's very clear. What he's about to say is a total lie. Ziba says, well, he's staying in Jerusalem because he thinks today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom. He says, Mephibosheth is staying thinking now this is the opportunity for him to become king. And David, in his desperation, I guess, buys into this. And verse 4, then the king says to Ziba, well, then all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. You get the whole estate. You get everything that was going to be his. And Ziba says, oh, I humbly bow, king. May I find favor in your eyes, my lord, the king. And we learn later that Mephibosheth was totally duped, didn't know what was going on, and actually would have been totally faithful to David. But here's a guy, Ziba, and he sees the king in a vulnerable place, and all he sees is, this is an opportunity to be taken advantage of for my own desire, so that I can get the estate. So he takes advantage of David's vulnerability, and as a result, he gets what he selfishly desires. He gets Mephibosheth's estate. Okay? All right, third snapshot. You still with me? We got 4 more. Okay, one more negative. This one's the most dramatic, the one you probably know about. If you didn't know about those first 2, I don't blame you. But this one you may have heard of. This is Shimei, and this guy's really negative response to David. Again, using the opportunity for his own purposes, his own desires. This is verse 5 of chapter 16. As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. Okay, this is also someone from Saul's household, and he has a lot of bitterness towards David for what happened in the past, and now he's got his opportunity. And he says he cursed David. Listen to this. This guy's got some gall. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood. And then Abishai, one of David's servants, says what I think any of us would want to say. Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. David, let me go and cut this guy's head off. Why are you putting up with this? And you see this amazing restraint from David. Really, you see, David is a broken man at this point, and he's willingly kind of enduring the consequences of his sin. Verse 11, he says to Abishai, his soldier, my son Absalom, who is my own flesh, he's trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjamite, this guy? Leave him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. We don't know if that's true or not, but he's saying, maybe, you know, this is my deal. It may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing I am receiving today. So David shows this amazing restraint and says, maybe this is all part of the consequences of what I've done, and maybe God will ultimately reward me for my faithfulness through this. So you've got this guy who sees David, and finally David's on the losing side, and this guy has been waiting for years, I guarantee it, to give a I told you so. And he's got a lot of bitterness in him, and so he sees this as an opportunity for revenge. He says, I'm going to go out, and David's down, and I'm going to kick him while he's down. And he curses, and he throws rocks at him. So you've got these three negative responses to God's anointed king. Now let's look at some positive responses, okay? Three positive responses in 15 and 16. First one comes from this guy named Ittai the Gittite. You want to say that a couple times? No? Okay. Ittai the Gittite, and he's a Philistine who has recently come into David's service. This is in verse 19. We're going backwards now in chapter 15. This is just when David starts leaving the city. And this is what David says to Ittai. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. He's already calling Absalom king. That's interesting. You're a foreigner. You're an exile from your homeland. You just came yesterday. You just came into my service recently. And today, shall I make you wander about with us when I do not even know where I'm going? Go back and take your countrymen. May my kindness and faithfulness be with you. So David's basically saying, hey, you're not even an Israelite. You're recent to my service. You shouldn't have to go and roam the desert with me. I release you from my service. You go and have a future that will be better for you. Look at this response from a Philistine. Verse 21, but Ittai replied to the king, as surely, and he reminds the king that he's king twice, as surely as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be. Really an amazing commitment from a guy who's recently in his service saying, hey, you're my king, you're God's anointed, and I am going with you through thick and thin. I'll go with you into the desert. I'll fight with you even to the death. Now, does that encounter sound like something we've heard this summer? Anybody? Yeah, it's kind of like Ruth, isn't it? It's not, Ruth and Naomi, when they're going back to Israel, and Naomi says, hey, you know what? You go back home. You know, I release you from there's no future for you with me. And Ruth says, hey, I'm with you to the death. Your God's going to be my God, and my future is with you. And you see this just amazing commitment from a guy we've never seen before, saying, you're the king, and I'm committed to you through thick and thin. All right, let's look at the second positive response. This is chapter 15, verse 31, okay? Now, David has gone up over the Mount of Olives. He's been weeping. And David hears, verse 31, David had been told Ahithophel, remember, that's the advisor who had betrayed him and gone over to Absalom. David hears this. David had been told Ahithophel is among conspirators with Absalom. And David knows what a shrewd and wise guy this advisor is. He's like, oh my gosh, if he's with Absalom, I'm in big trouble. So David prays, O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. God, you're going to have to do something to thwart his counsel, because I know everything he says is gold. And in verse 32, it's as if David's prayer is answered immediately. Very cool story. When David arrived at the summit where people used to worship God, right then, Hushai, the Archite, was there to meet him, his robe torn and dust on his head. Now, this is a guy who's also an advisor, and he's a faithful follower of David, and you can see by what he's done, he's torn his robe and dust is on his head. He's mourning. You can see he is feeling with David in the midst of him having to leave. And he's like an answer to David's prayer. And David asks something very bold of this guy, Hushai. Verse 33, David said to him, if you go with me, you'll be a burden to me, but, listen to this plan, if you return to the city, go back to Jerusalem, and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, but now I will be your servant. then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. So David's saying, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go back to Jerusalem as my spy, basically. And I want you to convince Absalom that you have defected from me and that you're faithful to him. And I want you to watch what happens. And when Ahithophel gives advice, I want you to give counter advice that won't be good for Absalom. I want you to be my spy. Asking him to put his life in danger, basically saying, you're going to be undercover and you're going to put yourself at great risk. And hopefully Absalom will buy this, that you're really sincere. But David's asking this really bold thing of him. And look at his response in verse 37. So David's friend Hushai arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering into the city. So he makes this decision, I'm for King David. And if that means being his spy and risking my life, I'm in. I'm game for it. And he goes back. And if you go to chapter 16, verse 15, you see when he meets up with Absalom. End of verse 16, he comes and sees Absalom. He says, long live the king, long live the king. He's got to sell this to him. Verse 17, Absalom asks Hushai, is this the love you show for your friend David? Why didn't you go with your friend? How can I trust you? And Hushai gives a great sell job. He says, no, the one chosen by the Lord, by these people and by all the men of Israel, his I will be and I will remain with him. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve the son just as I serve the father also? So I will serve you. And Absalom buys it. And what ends up happening is he is able to thwart Ahithophel's advice and do something strategic for the king. All right, last one, last snapshot. Another well-known name, Barzillai. And this guy is kind of a different situation. This is chapter 17. David has gone out of the city, and then they've crossed over the Jordan River, and they're going into the desert. And as they are, they're met by these three guys, and Barzillai is one of these guys. Verse 27, chapter 17. When David came to Mahanaim, man, this is hard stuff to read. Shobi, son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, there's the first guy, and Machir, son of Amiel from Lodabar, and then here's our guy, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogalim, here's what they did. They brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep and cheese from cow's milk for David and his men to eat. For they said, the people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert. So let me tell you about Barzillai. We learn more about him later, and we won't have a chance to read it. But this guy is about 80 years old. Okay, he's come to the end of his life, and he's out in the desert, and he sees David and his men coming, and he is faithful to David. And the reality is he's 80. He's got to be thinking, I can't go flee with you. I can't fight with you. But one thing he has money. He has resources. And so he says, I'm gonna give what I've got for you guys, and I'm going to provide for you and your men. I see that you're tired and hungry and thirsty, so I'm going to give you, you know, what I've got. And that's a great personal risk to him. I mean, if Absalom finds out that he's done that, he's in trouble. And so you got this 80-year-old guy coming towards the end, certainly of his career, but he's able to do what he can for the king, and he provides for the king. So three negative examples and three positive examples. All right, now let me just, in case you're wondering, since we're wrapping up the series, what happens? Let me just round off the story in a minute or two, and then we'll get to just some reflections. So here's what ends up happening. Chapter 17 and 18, David's out in the desert, and Absalom assembles this massive army. Yeah, this is under Hushai's advice, who's kind of David's spy. And they bring this massive army out into the desert, and they fight David's men. And Absalom's army is routed by David, just totally routed. And Absalom's got this, you'll remember the story, he's got that long flowing hair, and he's on his donkey, and he's riding past some oak trees, and his hair gets caught in the oak trees. And literally, I don't know, this sounds kind of cartoonish, but the donkey just keeps going, and he's stuck up in the air in the oak tree. And one of David's men, Joab, ends up killing Absalom. So Absalom's army is routed, and he's killed, and I'm kind of simplifying the story. But then in chapter 19, David now returns to Jerusalem. And well, let me show you. Go to chapter 19. Verse 14 and 15. So now Absalom is out of the way. And it says, verse 14, David won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, return, you and all your men. Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan, and eventually he's going to cross over back into Jerusalem. So it ends with David the king. First, he leaves the city, and now he returns to the city in a very different situation. He leaves broken, vulnerable, out of power, and he returns now as the conquering king, the only person who can sit on the throne. And what you get to see, and we can't read it all, but you get to see the consequences of people's decisions towards the king. And you saw these three guys who made these really bad decisions, you know, and they betrayed the king. And now the king returns, and now they have to live with their decision. So let me just show you real quick. So you've got Shimei, the guy who was throwing rocks at David, and you've got Ziba, that guy who tricked David into giving him Mephibosheth's estate. So let's just look at what happens here. Verse 16, I think it's kind of funny. So he crosses over the Jordan, and guess who is the first one to meet him? It's Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim. He hurries down with the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjamites, and Ziba is there too. So he's bringing all his men, all his clan, and Ziba's there. And verse 17, with him was Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and do whatever he wished. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, may my lord the king not hold me guilty. Don't remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind, for I, your servant, know that I've sinned. But today I've come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my lord the king. So he's groveling. He's on the ground and saying, please don't do anything. And same thing happens. David's servant says, hey, shouldn't I cut this guy's head off again? And David again says, you know what? This is not a day to shed blood. We're not going to shed blood today. And so he actually spares Shimei. But the first thing that David's son, Solomon, does when he becomes king is actually kill Shimei. And so it's sort of a postponed punishment. And then Ziba, David finds out that Mephibosheth, the guy with the lame feet, hadn't disobeyed him and hadn't betrayed him. And so he actually divides the inheritance between the two of them. And I guarantee you Ziba didn't have a great relationship with the king from that day forward. And just to round it off with the last guy, what's his name? Ahithophel, the counselor. What happens to him? Well, he's not even in this scene. And you know why? Because he's already taken his own life. So what happens is he advises the king to do one thing, and when the king takes the other guy's advice, he sees the writing on the wall. He realizes, oh my gosh, David's going to win this thing, and when he comes back, I'm in trouble. And so he goes home and he hangs himself. And so you see these kind of tragic consequences of these guys based off of their reaction to God's anointed king. So I know that's a lot of snapshots. I know that's a lot to try to hold in your mind. So I want to just end by simplifying this and just remind you, you've got these responses to the king. You've got these three negative responses and three positive responses. And as I see it, and this may be oversimplified, but I look at the three negative responses. What do they have in common? As you look at those three, what posture do they all have in common? And here's how I see it. What they all have in common is this. They're in it for themselves. They're in the midst of this you know, upheaval and clash of kingdoms, they're in it for themselves. They're out for their own selfish motivations, their own safety, their own future, their own protection. They're just making decisions because they're in it for themselves. Whether you look at this counselor, this advisor who's just trying to figure out which guy has the best chance of winning this thing, I'm going to be on his side because that'll be a better future. Or you look at Ziba and you say, the vulnerable situation the king is in, it gives me an opportunity to take advantage of him and get an estate out of it. Whether it's that guy, or whether it's Shimei, who is full of bitterness and you know, anger towards the king and sees the king is down and out, this is my opportunity to seek revenge. This is my opportunity to tell him I told you so in a big way. Whatever, they're all in it for themselves. And of course, in each case, that comes back to bite them in the end, as we see how the story goes. Because what they're doing, whether they realize it or not, is they were going against God's anointed king. And in doing that, they were ultimately going against God's kingdom, going against what God was doing in the world. And you look at these three positive responses. And as I see it, what they all have in common is this. They're all in it, not for themselves. They're all in it for God's king. They're in it for God's anointed king. And they're saying, you know what? I've sworn my allegiance to the king. I mean, he is my king. And it doesn't matter what he's going through right now. It doesn't matter what's happening. I've sworn my allegiance, and I am with him through thick or thin, through life or death, whatever. Every situation I find myself in just gives me another opportunity to demonstrate my allegiance to the king. Whether it's this Philistine soldier who says, you know what, I'm willing to leave a future of comfort to go and flee with the king and to fight with him even till death. Or whether it's Hushai, this guy says, I'm willing to risk my life and go back into Jerusalem and be his spy and risk my life in the process. Or whether it's Barzillai, who's this older guy who says, you know what, I can't fight for him, I can't run with him, but I can do something. I can give him my resources and provide for him in the wilderness. You got these three guys who are saying, our allegiance is with the king through thick and thin. And they make that decision at great risk of their own safety, their own future, their possessions, their own lives. They're in it for the king. And, of course, as the story goes, they end up being rewarded for that decision. And so I think about us today, and I look at the contrast between those three negative responses and the three positive responses and what drove them to make their decision. What a great picture for us today. What a great contrast for us today. And it's a great way to end this series, by, as we've looked at King David, by asking ourselves, how do we respond to God's king? How will we respond to God's king? And of course, now we're not talking about King David, because King David was just a precursor, right? He was just a foreshadow, pointing us forward to God's ultimate king. He was God's anointed at the time. And the Hebrew for anointed is Messiah, right? The Greek for anointed is? Christ, yes, anointed, Messiah, Christ, they all mean the same thing, anointed. And David was God's Messiah, his Christ, little m, little c. But his kingdom points us forward to the ultimate Messiah, capital M, the ultimate Christ, capital C, Jesus Christ. And now Jesus is God's chosen king. God is bringing his kingdom through his chosen man, Jesus Christ. And his kingdom, it's not just a kingdom over Israel, of course, but it's over the whole world, and his throne is in heaven. Paul says in Ephesians, God's plan now is to bring all things in heaven and earth, under the earth, all things together under one head, under one leader, under one king, Jesus Christ. In Philippians, he says, one day, every knee is going to bow. Every tongue is going to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. One day, everybody will acknowledge it, some to their horror and some to their great delight. But one day, everyone will acknowledge that Jesus Christ is King of the universe. He's God's anointed, and he rules over all things. But here's the deal, and here's the reality that we all know so well. Jesus says it, my kingdom is not of this world. And we know that right now he reigns in heaven, but that's not real clear as we go about our lives daily, right? It's not real clear who's in charge. It's not real clear who's king. And there are these other kingdoms, there's other forces at work in our lives that vie for our allegiance, that compete for our commitment. And you know what those are. I mean, it could be the kingdom of Hollywood. It could be the kingdom of entertainment that is putting itself in front of us every day. Or the kingdom of capitalism, the kingdom of materialism, the kingdom of cultural relativism, where everybody's thoughts and ideas are equally valid, equally appropriate. Of course, it could be our own kingdom, where we're trying to be in control, be our own king. And in the midst of that, sometimes Jesus doesn't exactly look like the conquering king. Sometimes he looks like the vulnerable king leaving the city. He doesn't look to be the one who's in charge. And so we find ourselves in a situation not unlike these six characters, where there's this clash of kingdoms, and we have to ask ourselves the question, where is my allegiance? Where is my commitment in the midst of these various forces competing for control? Where's my loyalty? And so that's how I want us to finish this series on the life of King David, by asking ourselves, where is my allegiance? And before we just answer with Jesus or not Jesus, something like that, I think a more fundamental question is, how do I even answer that question? And here's the question is, am I in it for myself? As I look at these things, am I just in it for myself? Or am I in it for God's anointed king? Am I in it for myself, or am I in it for God's anointed king? Or to put contemporary language around that, am I a consumer, or am I a committed follower? Am I just a consumer who's in it for myself, or am I a committed follower who is in it for the king through thick and thin? And those are radically different ways of approaching life. So let me just finish by talking about those. And you guys have heard this before. But here's what the consumer does. The consumer puts themselves at the center of the universe. They say, at the center of the universe is my personal fulfillment, my happiness, my comfort, my safety, my fulfillment as I define it. That's at the center. And then around that are all these products that are vying for my attention. All these things that I can take and consume and take in order to fulfill the center, which is my personal comfort, safety, joy, happiness, whatever it is. And so what I do is one day I choose this product, and one day I choose this product, or I choose sort of a combination that I think will best bring me personal fulfillment. But I exist at the center, and these things exist for me to find personal fulfillment. And you look at this story, and as I see it, you've got three guys who are thinking as consumers, thinking, which of these is going to bring me, you know, the most personal fulfillment? And then you've got the committed follower. And what the committed follower does is they place God's king at the center of the universe. They say, at the center is not my personal fulfillment. At the center is his glory, his fame, his reputation, his honor. That is what is at the center of the universe. And I exist in order to bring those things about. So the question in any situation is not, what am I requiring of him? What's going to bring me the most fulfillment? The question is, what is being required of me in this situation in order to bring glory to the king who is at the center? What is the king asking of me in this situation? And sometimes the answer will be courage. Sometimes the answer will be restraint, or humility, or love, or forgiveness, or many other things. But the essential question is, what is being required of me in order to bring glory to the one who is at the center, my king? How can I demonstrate my allegiance? So every challenge is an opportunity to demonstrate my allegiance, my commitment to the king. The committed follower says, I'm in this for the king, through thick and thin. The consumer says, I have no ultimate loyalties. I am loyal to my own personal fulfillment. And that's what's important. Now, that's not to say that the consumer has no commitments at all, right? The consumer will commit as long as that commitment is in line with personal fulfillment. That's how, as long as this brings personal fulfillment, I'll commit to it. I'll commit as long as it benefits me. I'll commit as long as my commitment doesn't force me to abandon these other products out there. And I thought I would close by giving some examples of consumer thinking, and you're going to relate to some of these. And I was kind of inspired by Jeff Foxworthy's old routine. You might be a consumer if you do this. So let me just give you a couple. This is pictures of consumer thinking. This is pictures of saying, I'm in it for me. You may be able to relate to some of these. You might be a consumer. These were just off the top of my head this weekend. If you just can't seem to find any time to be in God's Word with Him and in prayer in light of your busy schedule, if you just can't seem to find time, you might be a consumer. If your primary reason for coming to church is to provide a safe, moral environment for your kids, you might be a consumer. I like this one. If you ever determine whether or not you're going to go to church, whether this church or any other church, by who's preaching that Sunday and who's leading worship, you might be a consumer. If you're not married and you're sleeping around with your boyfriend or your girlfriend and you just can't figure out, I don't understand why this is that big of a deal to God. If that's the case, you might be a consumer. Giving of your resources. If you giving financial resources to God's kingdom causes, whatever they are, if that never causes you to change your standard of living in any way, you might be a consumer. If you're retired, and no significant part of your time now goes to serving God and his kingdom in intentional ways, you might be a consumer. If you're preaching a sermon and you care more about how you come across than how Jesus comes across, you might be a consumer. The consumer says, I'll commit to the extent that it benefits me. I'll commit to the extent that I can hold on to these other products and commitments. And I think Jesus looks into that situation, and I think what he would say to us is this: I'm not looking for consumers. I'm looking for committed followers. I'm looking for people who are 100% in. This is Luke 14. He says, basically says, I want your allegiance. I want it all. He says, if anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. Now, really strong language, hate. But what he's saying is if you're going to let anything, even these incredibly important relationships like a family and friends, or even your own life, if you're going to let anything come between your relationship with me, your devotion to me, you can't be my disciple. He says, if you're going to try to save your life, if you're going to try to hold on to personal safety and fulfillment, you'll lose your life for eternity. But if you are willing to give that up and give it away for me, you will find true life for eternity. And one day, the king is going to come back. The king is going to return to his city, and he's going to return in power. And on that day, we don't want to hear what he might say to consumers, which might be something like, you know, a lot of people called me Lord, Lord. But not everybody who called me Lord, Lord is entering the kingdom. We want to be part of those committed followers where he comes, he says, well done, good and faithful servants. You weren't perfect. You had a lot of brokenness and you messed up a lot, but you're committed. You stood by me through thick and thin. So my challenge as we end this is to take that question into your week this week. Just ask yourself, am I a consumer or am I a committed follower? Am I in this for myself or am I in it for God's anointed king? And I know the reality is for most of us, that's not a black or white answer, right? I mean, we're a mix of those things. And I think the question is really, where in my life, where am I acting and thinking like a consumer versus where am I acting and thinking like a committed follower? And I encourage you, just take that question into your week and observe how you think and the decisions you make and just acknowledge what's going on and bring it before the Lord and go, oh man, today I was a consumer today in that decision. That was the decision of a consumer. Talk about it with your friends. Talk about it with your spouses. Say, are you being a consumer? Are you being a committed follower? Make an honest assessment and bring it before the Lord and see what he does with that. And so I leave you with those words of our great king. If you try to hold on to your life, you try to save it, the irony is you'll lose it. But if you will give up your life 100%, in allegiance to me, you're going to find true life, and you'll find it forever. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you have anointed your king, you have sent him into the world, and now he sits with you at your right hand. And despite all appearances, he is in control. And one day, the whole world will know it. And we pray for the strength and the courage, even this week, to be your followers, your committed followers. And we acknowledge the ways where we come at this whole thing like consumers. And we want to commit ourselves to you more fully. We want to be people who you look at and say, you're not perfect, but nonetheless, well done. Well done, good and faithful servant. You remain faithful. So put us at the put yourself at the center of our lives. Remove us from the center and put yourself at the center, that we would worship you, we would find joy in you, and we would serve you. And as we do that, that we would bring glory to you and that the whole world would see just how great and awesome you are. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.